Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. My guest today, Ken Jennings, slept with a world atlas instead of a teddy bear as a kid. The Super Jeopardy winner is still crazy about maps. And he's not alone. There's a whole world out there of geography wonks, road atlas nuts, geocachers, and map collectors. From Here Be Dragons to Google Earth, old world and very new, maps have been capturing our imaginations for a long, long time. We'll go there today. This hour on Point, amazing maps and the people who love them. Joining me now from Seattle is Ken Jennings, Jeopardy super champ. He still holds the record for the longest winning streak there on the game show, 74 wins. His new book is Maphead, Charting the Wide, Weird World of Geography Wonks. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, where we've also posted a selection of really interesting maps. Ken Jennings, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Jeopardy guy, you're a darn good writer. This was really fun to read through. I didn't know what to expect, but you've got a very lilting style, and I guess it just makes sense for a Jeopardy champ. It's full of fantastic detail. Really, really nice.
That's nice of you to say. I guess the good part of trying to sell a book when you're a quiz show champion is that people have very low expectations for your prose style, so that means a lot.
Well, you come on strong, and it's terrific. It's funny how Proust makes his appearance in a couple places in this book. For him, it was the Madeleine that took him back to all things young and magical and far away in youth. For you, it was a book of maps you write right off.
It's true. If you want to look smart in a book, you got to mention Proust. And in this case, it was very easy because I had this experience of discovering my old world atlas at the bottom of a box in my parents' garage. And, you know, having not seen it in 20 years, it was just a magical moment when I pulled it out of the bottom of the box, just a sudden flashback to the months I saved up my allowance when I was 7 or 8 to buy this book, this $50 atlas. And I fell asleep every night poring over it.
You were one of a population right around the world that's had a touch of cartophilia. What is it? What makes it?
Cartophilia is the love of maps, and I think it's more common than we think. I don't know. I was surprised how many times while writing this book I would tell a friend, you know, I'm writing a book about people who like maps. And instead of saying, oh, that's weird, he or she would often be like, really? I really like maps, you know, right. But always with that whisper, like it's a little bit embarrassing. You don't want to out yourself from the map head closet.
But what do you think brings that on? I certainly relate to it. I mean, the smell, the look, the age, the changing history and boundaries and sort of human understanding of space and the planet we live on, it's all so beguiling to me. But you've talked with a lot of cartophiliacs in putting this together. What are the common threads? What pulls them this direction?
It sort of seems like, you know, now that I'm older, I look at a map and I see all the connections to history and science and geology and, you know, culture, anthropology. But at a very young age, I remember it was the beauty of the map itself, just something hypnotic about the shapes and maybe this powerful, very compelling idea for a child that you're finally the expert on something. You're finally having the God's eye view on something, which is, you know, the earth is seen from above. That's something very compelling about the map, that illusion at least of authority and stability.
You've got this great sort of child's eye vision of what shows up on a map where you, I guess with sort of that child's eye, are finding things that look alike. And you pull up Wisconsin, just the shape of the state, and Tanzania. I don't know who would think of that.
I always noticed that as a kid. I remember always thinking that Canadians must be more, you know, stronger, more robust, burlier versions of Americans, just because British Columbia looked to me like a more robust, substantial version of California.
Lake Michigan is kind of a carbon copy of Sweden. South Carolina is finding its shape mate in Lanai in the Hawaiian Islands. That's just globe spinning, I guess, and letting young eyes do the work.
Yeah, all the shapes had personalities for me. I remember thinking that Thailand sort of had a tail like a monkey, and Alaska was sort of looking across the Bering Strait at Russia. I mean, I don't want to sound like too odd a kid. I had real friends, too, but, you know, these were sort of my kids, too, the shapes of these states and countries on the map.
And then just the sound of all the names, the sort of faraway magic carpet ride, African rivers, you say, Lualaba, Jumba, Limpopo, and off you go.
Yeah, I remember I was probably vocalizing those under my breath often when I would look at maps because the names on them were what gave them the magic. I think at a very young age, I also started projecting myself into the map. So I wasn't just looking at a blue squiggle on the map. I was, you know, maybe rafting down the Zambezi River toward Victoria Falls or whatever it is. That's sort of the beauty of maps, of course, is the armchair exploration they bring us.
Now you're on to it. I think a lot of people will follow you right there. The sort of the magic carpet, stare at a map, look at those amazing names, look at all those amazing shapes. And off we go. Ken Jennings is with us. His new book is Maphead, all about kind of map-crazy people. And they're calling in already, Ken. Mary in Chesapeake, Virginia. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling in to say I adore maps, and I was inspired by the map room at the Vatican, visiting that one time. I lived in Europe for 10 years and became a map person, and to the point where I had a dining room just filled with old maps. And, you know, like Ken was saying, you see history, but it's the drawings of the maps. I have a beautiful one I'm staring at that is the Netherlands, and it's in the shape of the lion, which is the royal insignia, you know, dating back to the 1600s. And what a powerful statement to see that lion. And you still see the lion at the ING Bank, you know, because that's a Dutch bank. So I just love maps, and I think they're amazing. My children love them. The neighbors come in, and the children all are entranced by them.
Is it the age, the patina of age and time, or will a new map do just as well for you, Mary?
No, I think it's the artistry of the older ones tend to be more artistic. But I have maps that, you know, are replicas that look like they were made today. The colors are just astounding. So you can appreciate them from an artistic perspective, a historical perspective. Just, you know, oh, this is the world, or that's how people at such and such a time thought the world looked. And the changing of the boundaries also, as Ken said.
Lions and sea serpents and there be dragons where we don't know what's going on. Mary, I appreciate your call. There is that charm of the antique that the map carries so handsomely, Ken. And you write a lot about how people are just swept away by that. Old maps of Ortelius, or you name it, from early on. And the way the dragons appear in the corners where we don't know what's happening, or the lion, just for that embellishment that Mary loves.
It's sort of funny how, you know, today the thing we rely on maps for is their accuracy, and yet we're still very charmed by these old maps, which are very far from accurate. You know, in fact, we might love them more if there are charming mistakes, you know, the way that Spanish map makers drew California as an island for many years, I guess assuming that the Gulf of California ran all the way up to maybe the San Francisco Bay. Or on French maps of the 17th century, my own home is underwater because the Pacific Northwest has been carved out into this big non-existent, the Bay of the West, they called it. Between, you know, charming eras like these and just the knowledge of how much personal sacrifice went into these old maps, you know, how many sailors must have died so that a coastline could be drawn slightly more accurately. That's a sense of wonder you don't often get from Google Earth or from Rand McNally, for example.
What about that evolution across big time? You remind us that maps are older than writing. Give us that thumbnail history of how they come up, when they start to take shape.
Well, the very first time that we don't have some historical record of some guy, you know, Newton's apple moment of some caveman waking up and thinking, I think I'll draw the world's first map today. You know, they were something that gradually evolved over time. But, you know, the very first time some early human decided to, you know, walk around an obstacle and then, you know, get back on his usual route, you know, he was relying on a map in his head. And, you know, very shortly we start to see relics like this drawn on cave walls or carved into mammoth tusks in Siberia or the Ukraine or, you know, just carved on rocks. And often they're not, you know, Rand McNally level accuracy, you know, this is...
Not at all. These are projects of discovery and estimation.
Religious significance as well. You know, for them, the map was sort of merged with a religious icon. The Australian Aborigines, you know, still believe this way. They see geography not just as the shapes of the land, but as their perception of the land and the meaning of it.
When did we first begin to see large-scale maps, you know, that took on things as large as a continent or big regions or even the world?
The funny thing is, you know, the earliest paper maps tend to be... the accuracy is still dwarfed by religious significance. For many years, you know, the Earth would be divided into three parts on European maps: Europe, Africa, and Asia, with Jerusalem at the center and east always pointing up. That's where we get our word Orient, because maps were used to be oriented with the east up. and there would be very little water on this map. And these were all the results of biblical interpretation. You know, of course Jerusalem's in the center of the world. Of course seven times as much of the earth is land as is water. You know, it's clearly in Second Esdras, you know. And this was the kind of thing that would inform map making, these sort of abstruse interpretation of obscure scripture.
But it gets really interesting where you talk about how geography, which we traditionally just associated sort of, you know, like an overlay with maps, geography itself began to walk away from maps in the last century or become very suspect of maps. Why?
Yeah, this is sort of a recent phenomenon. The second half of the 20th century, universities began cutting geography departments. I think the idea was, you know, for many years, geography was the same as cartography. You know, you made maps to explore the earth. And I think the idea in the 50s was, well, the earth's now explored. We don't need this anymore. Of the top-ranked U.S. universities, I think the University of Chicago is the only one that still has a geography department, a very small faculty committee. And academic geographers still exist and still do write about the effect that land has on people and on culture. But they're very suspicious of maps. Maps aren't held to be infallible documents. They're seen the way literary professors tend to see texts now. They're narratives to reveal agendas about their authors and so forth. And that's certainly a valid way of looking at maps, and maps certainly do all have come with their own agendas and compromises and value judgments.
Right,
I think because maps are the thing that the layperson knows about geography, it's has done them no favors to sort of separate themselves from the one thing that people tend to love about their field.
Ken Jennings is with us. His new book is Maphead, Charting the Wide, Weird World of Geography Wonks. You can read an excerpt at our website, and you can join us. Is that you, a maphead, obsessed with the romance, the detail, the mystery of maps? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with Jeopardy! Super champ Ken Jennings about his love affair with maps and ours, the great romance of the map. His new book is Maphead, Charting the Wide, Weird World of Geography Wonks. And it goes to people of all ages, whether it's the map or the geography within, beneath, behind the map. Here's a little bit from the 2011 National Geographic Bee, hosted by Alex Trebek. Even Ken Jennings was impressed. The final question was, the southern region of Mount Everest is located in what Nepalese national park? Getting the right answer gave Tene Valenchik of Texas the win.
You have both written down the same response. If you are correct, then Tina will have 1 point more than you, Nilay. You had a choice here, Chomolungo or Sagamartha. You both wrote down Sagamartha. You are correct. And that means that Tina, by a margin of one, is the new champion.
Congratulations.
Way to go. We didn't miss one today. Let's get your mom up here. Where is she?
All right, Chumalungo or Samartha, let's go to the maps. Tina Valenchik there. Oh, boy, so was runner-up Nilay Sarda. Ken, you were sort of awed, as I say, even for a Jeopardy! Champ, by what these young people brought to their having clearly pored over maps for many, many, many hours.
I love how Alex is so matter-of-fact about that. Like, clearly it was either Chumalungo or Sagamartha, you know, as we all knew watching at home.
Of course, sir.
It goes without saying. Yeah, these kids were amazing. Amazing is too understated the word. I've been to the spelling bee as well, and those kids do remarkable things. But you know, when you think about it, they have to memorize Merriam-Webster's Third, and they're good. If they know every word in that one book, they cannot lose. Talking to these geography bee kids, they would run out of things to study. They would go to the library and just get the shelf on India and read the shelf on India. And they would literally run out of facts about India to know, you know, because that's how exhaustively they'd study. These are like 11, 12, 13-year-old kids. And when I would go head-to-head with them in a little geography quiz, and, you know, a 15-year-old girl would just smoke me. She'd know twice as much geography as me, and I was very impressed.
What did you love as a kid when your fingers did the walking over the globe or the atlas under your pillow? I mean, where did you like to go? What did you find there? Where did it take you?
I'm sort of an odd case. My family moved to South Korea from the Seattle area where I'm from. Mm-hmm. When I was 7 or 8. And I assume many map heads grow up looking at the exotic parts of the world, the jungles of Africa, the Amazon rainforest, the Himalayas. To me, you know, half a world away in Korea and sort of homesick for my for my homeland, I remember looking at like a road atlas map of Delaware and just thinking it, you know, amazingly exotic and looking at the little towns and hamlet names. You know, I'm probably the only person in the world who's ever thought of Delaware as exotic, I guess.
Of course, there's a lot more than Delaware as exotic. Once you get going, I mean, you remind us of figuring out whether it's in Athens or Tahiti or is it Weirton, West Virginia, the only town in the U.S. that borders two different states on opposite sides. What does it mean? Does it sit in a third state or it straddles two states?
It's in that little tiny panhandle of West Virginia that sort of sticks straight up between Ohio and Pennsylvania. So if you leave town going west, you're in Ohio. If you leave town going east, you're in Pennsylvania. You cannot leave town and stay in West Virginia.
Or this island up in the Canadian territory of Nunavut, which is a triple island. I hadn't even thought about what that might mean until I read you.
This is it's interesting to me, but possibly to no one else. But what the heck? It's my book. It's the world's largest, island in a lake, in an island, in a lake, on an island. So it's a triple island, I guess.
Can set kids off on a journey. Joseph Conrad wrote about that urge at the beginning of The Heart of Darkness, and Ken Jennings quotes him, "Now, when I was a little chap, I had a passion for maps," Conrad wrote. "I would look for hours at South America or Africa or Australia and lose myself in all the glories of exploration. At that time, there were many blank spaces on the earth, and when I saw one that looked particularly inviting on a map, but they all looked that, I would put my finger on it and say, when I grow up, I will go there." Ken Jennings quoting there Joseph Conrad. Richard in Cranston, Rhode Island, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Nice to hear from you. This is a great topic. I'm a former chair of a Department of Anthropology and Geography and an Africanist by profession. So I have my own Africa map collection. One of the many things that I get inspired by it is to see in the age of exploration and how technology kept improving our cartography. For example, the latitude was pretty well known, but longitude kept moving all over the place. And then in Africa in particular, where they didn't know the interior much, they just put big compass roses on Portolan atlases and hide their ignorance about what was going on. And then the exploration, you know, started from the coast inward, and so you see a whole history of consciousness. It's not just the history of maps and, of course, the history of printing. But, and I guess what inspired me is also to hold a piece of history that's 200, 300, 400 years old right in my hand, something that's literally walking out of time.
You know, Ken Jennings points right to that. He says map collectors miss a different past. They have the nostalgia of the silent film goer, the Civil War reenactor, the chess club fedora wearer. But let me ask you, Richard, with all your time in this, does it subtract from the majesty, the mystery for you that now we've got satellites that don't just map Africa or whatever it may be? They just stare at it. They actually show it to us, mapped or not. We don't need the map. We're looking at the actual thing.
No, I mean, as a collector, avid collector, the satellites just elaborate, give us a new dimension of consciousness and awareness. I mean, for example, in Africa, there were so many misunderstandings about which way the Niger went. Some people thought it was the headwaters of the Nile, or even where does the Nile come from? And since you mentioned the Civil War, at the time of the Civil War, no European had really ever really settled out where the Nile came from. And indeed, one of the great controversies and great dramas in cartography was the debate with Burton, which led to Speke's death on the day before this controversy was going to unfold. So you've got drama and history writing and passion and fascination of highest order, some of the great discoveries of Africa, in my case, but of the Amazon or Central Asia or whatever. So it's highly stimulating. And as for satellites and GPS, bring it on. We'll be happy to incorporate.
You're a thoroughly modern man, Richard. I appreciate your call. Ken Jennings, you remind us of just how long that sort of air of mystery around maps went on. The Mountains of Kong, I think it was, I read, showing up on maps. They don't exist, but they showed up on maps way into the 20th century anyway?
Yeah, the Mountains of Kong still appear in West Africa on a 1990s edition of Goods World Atlas. So once a mistake is made on a map, it often gets perpetuated. But, you know, the Conrad quote about blank spaces is interesting because, as you say, now, thanks to Google Earth and other technologies, we live in a time when there essentially are no blank spaces on maps. I mean, I guess Antarctica or Siberia, but, you know, we don't have the sense that these are blank because they're unexplored mysteries, we get the sense that they're blank because they sort of suck and no one wants to live there, you know? Now we have to sort of reinvent what exploration means. And I think that's what sort of unites a lot of the map cultures I met for this book is, you know, in an overexplored world, how do you continue to extract adventure and mystery from the places around us? How do you reinvent the map, you know? And so you have people discovering new things on Google Earth, for example, making the wilderness new by hiding little treasures in it and geocaching them with their GPS devices, or making maps of fantasy countries. These are all urges to explore for people who were natural explorers but tragically born centuries too late.
Proust wrote, and you remind us, that it was almost the names better than the places itself on the maps. He wrote, and you quote him, even on a stormy day, the name Florence or Venice would awaken the desire for sunshine, for lilies, for the palace of the Doges, and ride on. But what is a map now, Ken? I mean, when you've got Google Earth and you can actually see down to very tight detail what's actually there, is that a new kind of map? That pixelated representation of what's out there? Are we going to be walking in scenes that are digital images of something afar, and that is, in fact, our map?
The Google Earth is an interesting case because, you know, for many years, I assume you would have said a photograph of the Earth seen from space is not a map, it's a photograph. Google Earth blends, cartography and photography very artfully, and as a result, it does things that no map's been able to do. You know, for 500 years, if you think about it, maps have sort of been the same. You know, the blue parts were probably water. They probably had a grid of latitude and longitude, little dots for cities. Suddenly, here comes Google Earth, and now you can dive into the canyons like you're on a private plane, or you can zoom in on your own driveway and see the basketball sitting next to the backboard, or you can see where your friends are on the map in real time, or watch traffic and weather. I mean, my hope is that, you know, these are things that actually make the map come alive for kids who otherwise wouldn't be interested in geography and, actually make maps seem a little bit sexy for the first time in maybe hundreds of years.
You talked with Brian McClendon, who's with Google Earth, who, if I remember correctly, if you zoom all the way in when you come to the homepage of Google Earth, it actually comes to his apartment in Kansas City as a tribute to him. What kind of guy is this overseeing all that?
He reminded me of me. I guess the reason why he wants Google Earth to center on his childhood bedroom in Lawrence, Kansas is because that's where he would lie in bed poring over maps, just like me. He seems like a very weighty, serious man, and I sort of imagined him as having the weight of a whole world on his shoulders. I mean, he is in charge of Google Earth. It's not a real planet, but, in some ways it has every bit of the complexity of our world. Nowadays, things are often being discovered on his Earth before they're discovered on ours, you know, meteorite craters or lost jungle cities or things of that nature. A team of German scientists used Google Earth to prove that cows like to graze lined up north to south. It was the first proof that mammals could align to the Earth's magnetic fields. And I guess, you know, human beings have been looking at animals eating grass for thousands of years, but it wasn't until we decided to count on Google Earth that we made this amazing discovery.
Very dynamic digital maps and very marvelous old and mysterious maps all swirling at once in Ken Jennings' map head. John in Needham, Massachusetts. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I think the digital maps are great from a convenience perspective, but having been in the printing business for a number of years, I can tell you the beauty of those great topo maps and so forth is all about the number of layers that it takes to produce a map. If you think about the idea that maps actually are sort of a living document, they need to change from a production perspective. You can't afford to change the whole thing. So you have a totally separate layer for all the various topographic lines in a topo map or the names of the towns or streets. Because as those change, you need to have the craftsmanship and the process together to be able to do that without having to redo the entire map.
And you're talking here about when the map is going to be printed on paper, John, all those layers to allow that dynamism.
That's exactly right. And I think that contributes to the beauty of it. I've got topo maps, particularly the European variety. They're beautiful works of art. And if you appreciate how they're put together, with those layers, it just means that much more.
John, you're a map printer. Let me ask you, Ken Jennings quotes the great Elizabeth Bishop. She's got this wonderful kind of nuanced line. She says, "More delicate than the historians are the map makers' colors." More delicate than the historians are the map makers' colors and everything that's suggested and implied and defined by those colors. Can you relate to that, John?
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a hiker and you go on a hike and then you get the topographic map of the path that you've taken and you see the nuance associated with the orange topographic lines being bunched together in the very steep part of the trail, looking more deep orange than the ones that are spread apart, you can definitely appreciate the beauty of the subtlety of the color in the map.
John, I love your call and no doubt would love your work. I appreciate you being here with us. Ken Jennings, what about that wonderful Elizabeth quote, more delicate than the historians or the mapmaker's colors? How did you finally come to interpret what she's going at there?
There is something pretty about maps, and history is not always pretty. And I suppose that's one of the great temptations and pitfalls of maps, is that they often make the world seem stable and understandable. You know, after World War One, for example, you have European powers drawing these nice, neat horizontal and vertical lines to divide the Middle East into countries, and then sort of dusting their hands off and thinking, ah, jolly well done.
Done with that.
And,
yeah, right.
In practice, those nice, neat lines have not worked out so well in the successive century. But you know, just as a hobbyist, you know, you love these beautiful sort of restrained colors of these, the USGS hiker's maps that your caller refers to. I went to a map store, and the shelf that had all those wonderful quadrangle maps was very dusty. And the owner said, yeah, hikers just go with their cell phones now. You know, nobody buys one of these and pores over their route before they go hiking anymore. They just look on their smartphone.
Let's go to Elaine in Paintsville, Kentucky. Elaine, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. It's interesting that I just read an article by Cornell University professor Christine Leuenberger, and a colleague from Tel Aviv University in Dr. Schnell in Israel. And they wrote a book called The Politics of Maps, Constructing National Territories in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Or it wasn't a book, it's an article.
Okay.
And I was struck by the fact we always consider maps today as being very, very, exact. But when I was reading this article, I thought this is not true, at least on a national sense. I don't know, maybe on a geographical, larger perspective. But their article was to investigate the cartographic representations as socially embedded practices and address how visual rhetoric intersects with knowledge claims in cartography.
Whoa, okay.
And they come across so many strange maps, strange in the sense that whoever's making them changes the dynamics of the map or changes the size of the boundary or whatever. They say various groups and political parties increasingly use various cartographic techniques to forge territorial spaces.
Absolutely. Let me pick it up before the break here. We've got it, and I appreciate that, Elaine. I mean, you write about this exactly, Ken, about maps and academics, you know, emphasizing the unreliability or the way they can be massaged, their cultural baggage, their selectivity, the agendas that drive them. Cartography is loaded, Ken.
Yeah, and can become propaganda. You know, back in the Cold War, we loved these Mercator projection maps of the world that showed a big looming Russia, you know, dwarfing us. Just not because Russia's actually that big, but just because it happens to be near the North Pole, and Mercator projection exaggerates area up there. But that's what we needed. We needed a big enemy. Israel's another case where, there were actually death threats made against an Israeli government minister who decided to stop outlining, to change the outline color of the West Bank on a textbook map. Territory is taken very seriously, and the map is taken as shorthand for the territory.
Ken, lots of reaction online. Tina writes here, I still have my first map that I sent away for with a cereal box coupon and 25 cents. It was the Wild Bill Hickok treasure map, and it showed treasure right near where my grandparents lived in Florida. Just in her backyard. David writes online, as a child, I had vivid dreams for months after visiting the Maparium 30-foot walk-through globe at the Christian Science Publishing Building in Boston, a must-see, and it surely is. And then this one, maybe for you, Jess. Jess writes, Ken, my son is map crazy, much like his father, but since age 6, he's loved to draw and read maps. It's amazing with geography. She says, is there such a thing as a cartography camp? What about it, Ken?
I don't know about cartography camp, but it sounds great. It's striking to me that all these stories come from children because, you know, that was sort of when my map obsession peaked as well. We think of all these geeky hobbies out there as being the province of middle-aged men. You know, you hit your midlife crisis, and that's when dad starts playing the banjo or brewing root beer in the basement. But the love of maps is very different. It's 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds. It's written in our genes. Map people seem to be hardwired that way. And I don't know what it is, a good spatial sense, a love of, you know, an aesthetic sense. I don't know what it is, but we come out of the box that way.
We've got video at the website of a 2-year-old or nearly 2-year-old with an amazing understanding of global geography. Just amazing. You speculate in the book Maphead, Ken, that to be honest about it, not everybody's into maps. Some people look at maps and it just doesn't relate to what they see around them. You speculate that there may be some genetic, spatial capacity. People who look at a map and it just pops up into 3D for them easily may like maps more than people who just aren't wired that way.
Yeah, I would say there's probably more people who are the opposite of me, the anti-map head, the people for whom maps signify anxiety, frustration, being lost, you know, because they look at them only when they're lost, and then they get annoyed that they can't tell which way to turn in the mall to hit JCPenney's or where they left their car in the parking lot or whatever it is. That's sad to me because there's good evidence that these things can change, that we actually can train our brains to read maps and have a better sense of direction. It just takes awareness and practice. But the spatial sense is important. I think these map heads might be the people who grow up and actually can follow the pictures in IKEA instructions just because that's the way their brain works.
Maybe. Here's a comment from Susanna. She says, I've always loved navigating new places with maps. I've just gotten an iPhone and I'm grappling with the ease of navigating mindlessly with my phone now. I feel less connected to my sense of place. What about it? I mean, could this atrophy in the iPhone era or the GPS era, you just sort of plug in where you want to go and it says turn right, turn left, go straight. You don't have to visualize it anymore, Ken.
That is my great fear, because this could be the death knell for maps. Not for map heads, but in our culture at large, I think. There's a great scientific study that was done of London cab drivers that showed that if they did brain scans, CAT scans, before and after they passed the exhaustive test of London street knowledge that they have to take to get their license, the test would actually show that their hippocampuses, the part of the brain that navigates for us, would actually get physically bigger. And I sort of have this nightmarish vision of all of us, you know, becoming GPS following drones. And I'm as bad as anybody. I love my GPS. I keep it in the car. I love its crisp British accent. The kids call it Daniel and want to bring it into the store with us because they love Daniel so much.
Right.
But I'm afraid, you know, that it's turning us into people who, instead of understanding maps and space, just teach us to follow directions. And that's why you get all these, you know, hilarious but sort of scary news stories of people following their GPS right into a lake or onto railroad tracks or whatever it is.
Whatever it says, that's where we'll go. Carol in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm actually in New Haven. I'm from Boston. I'm a BUR listener.
Great.
And thank you so much for the program. I actually heard you speak at the JFK Library, and I listen every day. I'm on my way to Pennsylvania to visit my son. I've been a map fanatic my entire life, and I just want to comment on... am I talking too loud?
Not at all. What do you know?
Okay. I want to comment on Ken's comment about GPSs, because I actually, when they told me I was high on the queue, I had to get off the highway, and I knew where I was because I always look at my maps. And even though I use a GPS, I'm traveling alone right now, and I love being able to have the map on my lap when I'm with someone and see where I can get off and see new places, and can't do that with a GPS. But I'm a map fanatic. I've been a map fanatic my whole life, and I started out when I was a child, but I spent a long time in the travel business, traveled everywhere. I taught travel and tourism for 12 years at Fisher College. Then I got a whole bunch of people to love maps. Then I got a master's at BU in city planning, maps again. I wear two hats now. One of them is I teach in the graduate school at Lesley, social studies methods, and I have excited at least 500 people who are going to be elementary school teachers about maps.
Carol, it sounds like you're not just a map fanatic. You're a map evangelist there, and I love it. I think a lot of people share it. Keep an eye on the road, though, while you're watching that map. And thanks for calling, Carol. One more right here, Ryan in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I'm a private pilot, actually a student pilot too, and I just wanted to comment on how in the early days of aviation, a lot of major map discoveries were paved the way by with aviation, with people like Charles Lindbergh and
sure.
the early airlines and airmail routes, and so I just wanted to hear your comments on that.
Ken Jennings, how about it? All those guys and gals on the wing who helped us learn what was out there and map it.
Right. I mean, aviation was Google Earth 100 years before Google Earth. Finally, we could see these contours from above and not have to rely on, careful plotting and surveying from a ship in a harbor or following a coastline or whatever it was. And air travel created a great American romance with maps. You know, airlines actually used to put maps in the seat pocket in front of you so you could follow your route and actually know at all times which city you were passing out the window. People used to look out the window on planes. It's amazing. I think now the only map in the seat pocket in front of you is the terminal you're going to, so you know if you're going to make your connection or not. We have lost that romance of seeing the territory from the air. Not me. I'm always glued to the window when I fly.
Yeah, though a lot of them now project that map of where the airplane is, especially on international flights. You can see the little symbol of the plane inching across the Atlantic, north of Iceland, south of Greenland, making its way toward Newfoundland or wherever it may be, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, GPS has actually brought some of that back, which is nice. I was on a plane yesterday, and all three of us in our row had the map on as we were somehow hypnotized by our little plane inching pixel by pixel across the country.
Much higher than aviation, you remind us of this moment. I guess it was May 1st, 2001, just a decade ago, when an unnamed hero, as you write at the U.S. Air Force Space Command, on the planes just out, high planes just out of Colorado Springs, pressed a button, and instantly, gave GPS to the world? The military had it, and suddenly it was available to civilians.
Yeah, apparently we'd been scrambling it for many years. The first GPS satellites had been in orbit since the 70s, I want to say, but the military had been scrambling it so that civilians could not get actual coordinates. You know, they could get within, I don't know, 1,000 feet, but not within 10 feet or 1 foot like we can today. And suddenly this guy presses the button, and now everyone on Earth has GPS. You know, we can all know down to a few feet where we are standing on the surface of the Earth. And it's because of this, billion-dollar array of military satellites in space. I can't get over that every time I see the little image of a car on my car GPS take a left, or every time I'm geocaching in the woods and my device, the numbers on my device change every time I take two steps. There are satellites in space telling me this. It's an amazing futuristic thing.
It's not Amerigo Vespucci or Tilius. Geocaching, you just mentioned. C-A-C-H-I-N-G. What's geocaching? I was introduced to it in your work, Ken.
Yeah, it's funny how few people know about it, considering that there are well over 1 million geocaches hidden around the world, 4 to 5 million practitioners. Its founders call it the world's most popular hobby that no one knows about. Essentially,
simple. What is a geocache? What are geocaches?
Right, you hide some hidden object, often just a log that can be signed by discoverers, a piece of paper that can be signed in some kind of container. Maybe it's a piece of Tupperware that also has some little toys, Happy Meal trinkets, Cracker Jack prizes, and you hide it somewhere. Maybe in the woods. Maybe it could be in a busy street corner, and you put the latitude and longitude of that spot on the internet. And people like to find it. People use their GPSs as a treasure hunting device, as if they were looking for pirate gold, except, again, they're using billion-dollar military satellites to find pieces of Tupperware that somebody's hidden in the forest.
But what's the sport if you just are following your iPhone and it's telling you, go here, go there? Are they up on top of trees or something? Or
yes, and often they may be hidden very cleverly. You know, they may be disguised as a fallen log. They may be inside a pine cone. I was geocaching yesterday. I had an hour to kill, and I found one that was hidden inside a fake grasshopper. So what I at first took for a grasshopper actually had a little tiny geocache hidden inside.
Amazing.
It.
So do you leave a mark there when you found it and for the next person to find?
That's right. That is the explorer's thrill. You know, you write your name on a little piece of paper, and you sort of feel like for a moment you are Magellan or you are Columbus. You have made a new discovery and spotted a new treasure in an overexplored world.
Wow. Dr. Livingston, I presume, or a grasshopper in the woods. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on with Ken Jennings.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a rather curious thing, okay? I'm 68, and I've been blind since I was 1.5.
Okay.
And I've been in love with tactile maps since I was exposed to one. Maybe I was 9 or 10, because I didn't have tactile maps that kids got introduced to that early, back way back then.
Jim, when you say tactile map, do you mean just the kind of raised relief map that we've all seen?
Or relief maps with different textures for oceans and lines for states and countries and things, or for
right.
mountains, you got little bumps and things. I've been fascinated with maps since I was a kid. And everybody talks about the visuals. I'm wondering what it is. There's something, it's not just the visuals. There's something else that draws people, because I'm not the only blind nut that's fascinated by maps.
You know, I absolutely love this. Would you say then, Jim, at 68, with a lifetime of running your fingers across those tactile maps, do you have a feeling that you, I'm not sure what the right word is here, visualize or...
Right, visualize, yeah.
The world, the world.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I visualize the world. I love the shapes of countries. I know, like knowing where things are, but I visualize it. I can sort of picture myself thinking, okay, that's X, you know, South Africa or China or wherever it is.
How terrific. How terrific. Ken Jennings, what do you say to our great, blind avatar of tactile maps?
It's remarkable, you know, because I guess I realize my assumption that there's something visual about this has been a little bit limited, a little bit blinkered. You know, I guess the idea that there can be a miniature representation of the world that we can pore over and study and know in great detail is not related to sight at all. You know, it can come through any of our senses. Maybe there's an olfactory map out there that's just as exciting. This is wonderful.
Jim, you add dimension to our sighted sense of what the world, how it might be perceived. I really appreciate your call. One more from Pittsburgh. Mike, you're on the air, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show. It kind of combined a few of the callers that go together, and I've been thinking about what about underwater mapping, celestial body, like lunar mapping, and what would be, besides those, the least mapped area of the Earth? Thanks a lot. I'm going to listen to your call off the line.
Yeah, Mike, thank you. I mean, it reminds me, Ken, first of your... looking out in on James Joyce and thinking of the way you liked to think of where you were in the world when you were a kid. You took it from your street to your, you know, state, country, right on up into the universe. But what about the boundaries of what we're mapping these days?
It is interesting because, you know, I say we live in an overexplored world, but of course we are still mapping things. We're mapping space, we're mapping Mars, we're mapping the human genome. To a locationally minded person like me who likes to be surrounded by these terrains, you know, it's not quite as fun. You know, I know I'll probably never be in these places. I'm not mapping something I can walk through, and that's a little bit sad to me. But yeah, there are still many, many frontiers to be mapped. And I don't know if this is still true in the Google Earth era, but I know as recently as the 90s, you know, we had better maps of Mars than we did of the underwater world, for example, the bottom of the ocean, or of Antarctica. So yeah, there are still mysteries out there. There are still new things being discovered every day, some on Google Earth, but hey, some still on actual Earth.
Yeah. Aaron in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Mike, thanks for calling in Pittsburgh. Aaron, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, thrilled to be part of this. My husband is one of those people that did not pick up the banjo in midlife, but picked up map craziness. He's turning 48 coincidentally today. And
Happy
he's
birthday.
Been working on a website, rootloops.com, for a number of years now, and it's just his passion. Every waking moment, even when he should be sleeping, is spent, it's a thing that you use maps to generate bicycle routes. So you put in your address and you say, I want to go 10 miles, I want to go 50 miles, I want to go 3 miles, and it will create a route. And then you load it onto your GPS and off you go.
And what does it give you a good route or a bad route or a scenic route or what?
Well, the thing of it is it gives you a random route. So he did it because he got sick of riding the same places over and over and over that he knew about. And so it just randomly gives you routes. And so you can go on the computer and you can shift it if you know that you don't want to go to that neighborhood or you don't want to go here or there. And you can kind of customize the map. But it gives you a break from your routine. Or you can use it if you're traveling and you don't know where you are and things like that.
I love it. Endless ingenuity in sort of mapping new ways around the world, even a world that we know well, rootloops.com. Aaron, I appreciate your calling in there. Ken, you quote Brian McClendon. This is the Google Earth guy, and he talks about what you describe as Google's Borgesian dream of centimeter per pixel real-time world map as the end of resolution. What's he talking about there? Where does that take us?
It sort of comes from a Lewis Carroll, sort of a whimsical Lewis Carroll thought experiment from his book Sylvie and Bruno about a planet of people who are not satisfied with a 1 to 500 scale map or a 1 to, you know, even a 1 to 50 scale map. They want a 1 to 1 scale map of the world. Essentially, if you think about it, the map would be as big as the territory. You could never unroll it. And that's sort of what Google Earth is becoming. You know, their dream is a centimeter per pixel. It's in four dimensions. It changes in real time. You see weather and traffic moving across the globe as it happens. And that would essentially be the end of resolution. That would be the map, the map. You know, why would you need any other map when you have a centimeter per pixel of the entire world?
Well, wouldn't you then need a map for this alternative universe of the map, the one-to-one? You know what I mean?
That's right. You know, a map is a map that big even useful? You know, you would need a map to guide you through the map. But I like to think that's a ways off. I like to think that maps still do have some of their aura of mystery. And, you know, we will never get to the map that ends mapping, you know, maybe because we will outgrow this little planet. I don't know. But map lovers like to think that, the map urge will not end.
Maybe we won't get there because we don't want to. You make us not want to lose maps, Ken, and it's just a terrific journey through the map of your mapophilia. The new book is Maphead, Charting the Wide Weird World of Geography Wonks. Ken Jennings, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was a real pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.